From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. So what does it take to make a city burn? In 1961, Bel Air found out. It sits in the hills above Los Angeles. And when a wildfire swept through neighborhoods there, it was an eye-opener. This is an L.A. Fire Department documentary made in the 60s.
Designed for disaster. Plants wither. Trees and brush become crackling dry.
It shows scenes that shocked people at the time. Wooden roofs and yards filled with overgrown vegetation that fed flames as the fire swept through an exclusive neighborhood. Thousands fled their homes as fire crews struggled to contain the blaze.
The potential of 134 square miles of thick, dry chaparral and oak, all within the city boundaries of Los Angeles, classed by experts as the fastest-burning ground cover in the Western Hemisphere. And nestled in that cover, one of the greatest concentrations of high-value homes in America. A
serious problem. Hundreds of homes were destroyed. In the 6,100-acre firestorm that still ranks among the 20 most damaging fires in California history. Fire historian Stephen Pine calls this the beginning of a new era in fighting wildfires.
The Bel Air fire really was a real stunner. To have what was nominally a city burn like this. In most of the industrial world, you had to have an earthquake or a war to be able to shatter the system sufficiently to burn large chunks of city.
During the 55 years since Bel Air burned, wildfires within city limits have become way more common. But the question is why, and just how widespread are they? That's what Eric Segarra wanted to find out. He's a data journalist at Reveal, and he spent about a year analyzing data at his desk and reporting in the field to figure out why more Americans are at risk of losing their homes and even their lives to wildfire. Eric brought in some of what he carries with him when he heads out to cover fires. So, Eric, what do you got?
So in this bag, we have some of the fire gear that we took with us on our road trip through Southern California and Northern Arizona. It's a big jumble of mess here. Okay, so we bring in our fire boots, we bring in the fire retardant pants and shirts, gloves, a helmet, and a fire shelter.
So what does a fire shelter do?
So the fire shelter is kind of the last resort for a firefighter in trouble in the wildfire situation. And the way it works is they yank it out and they unfold this big, massive thing.
And they get under it?
Right. And so they get under it. I've heard it called things like a Jiffy Pop bag or a shake and bake.
It totally looks like a Jiffy Pop.
So once they deploy these things, they take it up, they put it on, they fall down into the ground, and they're covered by it, and they're not supposed to get out no matter what.
That's intense. Now, you've been reporting on fires for a long time, right?
Yeah, I started reporting fires in the early 2000s as an intern, and I went so far as to go ahead and get trained as a wildland firefighter, at least take the basic training levels.
You know, what are you seeing differently? Because now you're not just focused on one area, you're looking at the whole country.
Right. And this allows me then to go ahead and use my expertise as a data reporter to look at some of the data sets that are out there covering this sort of issue and analyze some of the trends that we're seeing. Basically, fires are getting larger throughout the United States, particularly in the West. But throughout the United States, we're seeing an increase in fire size.
Does development have anything to do with all of this?
It does, actually. The population growth is huge in these areas right now, and that's an issue.
So fires are now year-round. They're getting a lot bigger, and they're spreading beyond the West, happening all over the country. And because people are settling in these wild areas, we're actually seeing more damage to homes and more lives lost. That's what landed Eric back in Los Angeles County, where nowadays, it's always fire season. Since the Bel Air fire, there have been nearly 1,500 other fires in California's most populated county. He arrives in mid-July, just in time for what's known as the Sand Fire, named after nearby Sand Canyon.
This is a hot, fast fire in canyons where scattered neighborhoods dot the Angeles National Forest. Three of us from Reveal ride in a rented SUV along roads lined with chaparral. It's a bush that sweats flammable oil when it's warm. We stop where the road cuts through the hillside. On the other side is just a wall of smoke. We back into a parking space and leave the engine running in case we need to leave quickly. Nearby, A group of firefighters is planning the air attack.
So we're trying to keep it from jumping this ridge line.
Up on the south side, down low in the canyon.
That's Andrew Violante from the San Marcos Fire Department.
Well, the main head of the fire is running north, and we're trying to keep this slop over side of the fire from moving this way. And we have air support in the air painting this whole ridgeline with retardant.
Soon, a heavy lift helicopter hovers in low, dropping loads of neon pink retardant from the sky. By accident, I get a mouthful.
Oh, the fire retardant? It tasted just like dish soap.
Even with the ground and air fight, I can still see fire lurking around the mountain.
We've got flames on either side of the road, including up on the ridgeline. I can see the fire torching through some larger brush about 50 feet away. And I should feel the heat on my face from the hillside that's burning next to me. Woo-wee.
Just on the other side of that hill, a suburban neighborhood pushes into the wildland area.
There's flames to the, just about every direction you look.
Firefighters are positioned on the hill around an evacuated cul-de-sac, ready to defend homes. There's something so post-apocalyptic about a suburban neighborhood on a sunny day with no people. Sprinklers are running on the rooftops in a feeble attempt to keep their homes safe.
To me, it's just wasting water.
Firefighters like Dave Schwab from Ventura County have parked their engines. They're scattered throughout the neighborhood, just waiting for the fire to hit. I see other firefighters perched on rooftops. They have a better view of the flames from there and can put out any embers that fly their way. Homeowners in this area have lived with fires like this. Many have cleared brush around their houses to create what firefighters call defensible space.
They've given us a fighting chance to help, you know. So it's the properties where you don't see that it's just difficult for us, and then it makes it dangerous for us.
Dangerous and expensive. In California, it costs $1,700 an acre to put out fires where wildland meets homes. The Agriculture Department's Inspector General reports that's more than twice what it costs to fight fires in forests without people. Stephen Pine has written 20 books examining all this.
We know how to keep houses from burning. We've known it for a long time.
Problem is, more people than ever choose to live near nature. To find out just how many people that is, I analyzed a database from the University of Wisconsin. It has millions of records that help me pinpoint where houses mingle with wildland. I found that more than a third of the nearly 16 million homes built in the U.S. since 2000 are in places at risk of wildfires. The sand fire is only 10% contained when some of the 20,000 evacuees are allowed to return. Homeowner Sherilyn Gomez is one of them. I ask her, what does all this look like to people who have never seen a wildfire?
It twirls and it moves and it's unpredictable. You know, at times it was going three different directions at the same time and the winds would change and swirl and you're just hoping and praying it isn't going to get, you know, anybody. This is the third one I can remember that was actually real threatening.
And have you evacuated in the past?
Yes, three times. Why do we stay? It's a wonderful neighborhood. It's a wonderful community and we take our chances. And, you know, the odds are, I mean, we're still, after three fires, we're still here.
As we drive away past the blackened landscape, a column of smoke rises in the dirt-brown sky. It would take 12 days for firefighters to contain the sand fire. It killed a man, destroyed 18 homes, burned more than 40,000 acres, and stripped the hillsides of every living thing. Why do fires like this still happen? To learn more, I went to see Wally Covington, who heads the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University. He looks like a tall, outdoorsy grandfather with a twinkle in his eye. His research has changed the way Americans manage forests through techniques he calls treatment, cutting down trees to thin the forest, setting controlled burns, that kind of thing. Wally tells me that 100-acre fires used to be outliers, freak occurrences.
Then it got to be 1,000 acres, and people said, well, still, it's an unusual event. It's a really dry year, lightning hit in the wrong place and so on. But once it got into the every year in and year out, millions of acres burning each year, then people said, whoa, something's bad here, something's wrong.
The two of us stand in a swath of forest divided by a dirt path. On one side, large centuries-old pines with orange-yellow bark dot an open landscape. This is the way, Wally says, forests should look. On the other side, younger, darker pines stand in what people call a dog hair patch, dense like the hair on the back of a dog. This is what many forests look like today. Wally studies the two sides in his outdoor laboratory, where he tries to restore the forest. To explain why, he carries a cross-section of stump from a tree that began growing in the late 1600s. The rings in this stump tell the story of forest policy over 500 years. In the middle of this stump, the tree was young. Its rings are wide, indicating healthy growth. Then, lightning struck it in 1757. From that time forward, you can see the stump is lined with scars from fires. There's 1773, 1785, 1803. So this forest is supposed to burn every 2 to 7 years under natural conditions. That's 1839, 1857. All told, 18 fires from 1757 to 1876. Then the fires stopped.
Shortly after 1876, cattle and livestock grazing began in earnest out here, and serious overgrazing.
Wally points out the tree's rings got thinner as it continued to grow. That's because it had to compete with more vegetation for the nutrients it needed to stay alive. This made it more vulnerable to insects, drought, and fire. Conditions like this affect millions of trees throughout the country.
This overgrazing was actually encouraged by early foresters as a way to keep fire out of the forest, because fire was seen as the enemy.
Now scientists say climate change will alter fire activity throughout the United States. Wet periods will be wetter, dry periods drier. Storms will bring less rain and snow. Instead, we'll see more lightning that sparks wildfires and wind that can drive flames with explosive force.
The story has still nationally been one where stupid Westerners are putting houses where there are fires. And that's true.
Stephen Pine knows this from experience. He spent 15 years as a wildland firefighter. He used what he knew to keep his vacation home safe from a fire 5 years ago.
But if the climate change modelers are correct, we're going to start seeing the fires go to where the houses are. And that's going to be increasingly be on the east. At that point, it becomes a national story.
There's a lot of information about wildfires in the West because there's more federal land there, and the federal government keeps track of all that data. We know less about wildfires in the East because state and local fire agencies don't always track the same information. The data we do have shows that 70% of wildfires occur outside of Western states. But one estimate says local firefighters respond to 900 wildfires each day on average. We also know many local departments aren't prepared for wildfires. These fires are probably smaller than what we see on television. An acre here, an acre there. That small grass fire by the side of the road may not seem like a big deal until it rages out of control. All it takes is an ember carried by an unexpected gust of wind. That's what happened in South Carolina 3 years ago.
It never even crossed my mind that I could potentially lose everything to a fire.
Jody Aldridge's condo burned in a fire. There have been more than 78,000 fires in her state between 1992 and 2013.
If you drove from one street to the next street, you could look down and see flames. You imagine two-story condos, there's four units in each building, and there's nothing but flames and black smoke.
Flames jumped from bush to bush and building to building. They melted the white picket fences that lined the streets.
I mean, usually what we get are smaller brush fires, but other than that, it had never been this huge danger that we had heard of.
Jody left behind a puppy called Puck and pretty much everything else.
Baby pictures, things from high school, some of the things as a woman you hold on to a certain outfit because you remember an event that was special to you, that you wore that to, things like that that I can't ever get back.
After the fire, she trained to become a volunteer firefighter and got a better understanding of just how much the homes and the people who live in them are at risk.
I don't know if I'm more aware of it now, but I do feel like the number of fires have increased each year.
More fires mean more homes are likely to burn. There's no getting around that, says Jim Hubbard. He is the man in charge of wildfires for the Forest Service.
I would say that we will continue to lose buildings and homes. There are just some that aren't going to be saved.
He says saving the lives of residents and firefighters has to be his agency's top priority.
That means there are some places at some times that we won't be able to save the buildings.
Stephen Pine says leaders need to cultivate the political will for change around wildfire policies.
I wonder, well, how did cities quit burning? It's because there were political decisions about building codes, fire insurance standards. There were fundamental issues that were not left to the market, not left to individual or developers' whims. And until we have a political decision on that scale, you're not going to solve the problem. In cities, every fire you put out is a problem solved. In wildlands, most wildlands, every fire you put out is a problem put off.
The U.S. Forest Service owns 100 million acres of overgrown land that need treatment. More than half is at high risk of fire. The agency spends $300 million a year to thin the forest. That covers about 3% of the work it needs to do. Doubling the budget wouldn't come close to finishing the job. What will it cost?
What I can tell you is more money than is likely to be available. We will never have enough money to treat all of the land.
Within budgetary limits, Jim Hubbard of the Forest Service is careful not to make any promises his agency can't keep.
We can't eliminate fire, and we can't restore the forest with just a 10,000-acre treatment. But we might be able to reduce the risk to a community with that treatment.
Forest Service officials decide where to treat using a risk analysis tool. A cold-sounding term, especially when the decisions they make mean that some places will burn. But they don't analyze the risk on every treatment, so there's no way to tell if what they're doing is preventing homes from burning down.
It's certainly being done nationally, regionally, and now we're trying to make sure that the forests and the districts understand how to use the tool. And I wouldn't say we're there everywhere, but it's coming fast.
Jim says the Forest Service has fallen short of its treatment goals the last couple of years because it's still forming alliances with private, military, and state landowners.
We can do a lot of treatments, but if we want to be effective, it requires all of us acknowledging the problem that we will need to manage unplanned wildfire in ways that we haven't in the past.
Thanks to Reveal's Eric Segarra for bringing us that story. Now, we've seen what happens when wildfire tears through a city or town. But what happens next? When we come back, we'll hear how some developers are profiting off of wildfires and rebuilding homes in places that stand a good chance of burning down again.
I've only put $3,500 into it.
Yeah,
I sold it to the neighbor for $3,500 more.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hi, I'm Scott Pham, a data reporter at Reveal. As you're hearing, wildfires that have long been considered a problem exclusive to the West now threaten many other parts of the country. Go to revealnews.org/wildfires. There, you can read about how wildfires are becoming more frequent and widespread. You'll see where communities in your state are most vulnerable to wildfires and how prepared your fire departments are to fight them. Be sure to also watch our 360 video that shows how one community might have a solution. Again, that's revealnews.org/wildfires.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. When we talk about wildfires, objects may be closer than they appear. People in Yarnell, Arizona, about 90 miles northwest of Phoenix, learned that the hard way back in 2013. Their town became a national example of how expensive and dangerous it can be to try and tame a wildfire. Yarnell Hill Fire took the lives of 19 specially trained firefighters, Granite Mountain Hotshots. Now, that was the most deaths of wildland firefighters since the 1930s.
The fire also destroyed more than 100 homes. Fast forward from 2013 to today, and surprisingly, development in the area is going strong. Homes are being rebuilt even though the threat of wildfire is still there. Reveal's Emmanuel Martinez takes us there.
The Yarnell Hill fire started on a Friday with a lightning strike. It was small at first, about half an acre, and it wasn't supposed to get much bigger. It was far enough from town that it caught Brian Smith off guard.
I got calls, is there a fire? And I kept looking around and I seen no fire.
Brian is a lanky retired chemist who wears glasses held together with scotch tape. He's lived in Yarnell for almost 10 years. It's a rural town in an unincorporated part of Yavapai County. Brian ended up here because of his dad.
He was tired of the desert. It's hotter than hell. And then he retired up here because of the breeze. Actually, it's so peaceful here.
A sign on the edge of town describes it as a place where the desert breeze meets the mountain air. Those same breezes can turn into powerful gusts of wind without warning. On top of that, the region was bone dry. 50 years had passed without a major wildfire. When the 2013 fire started, it threatened two neighboring towns. 2 days later, a thunderstorm hit the area. Its 40-mile-an-hour winds carried the fire straight towards the weeds, bushes, and trees that brushed against many of the houses in Yarnell.
The sparks and embers started coming this way. And just at this time of the year, things are pretty dry. So, you know, wherever they landed, just poof, it exploded.
One of those embers landed on Brian's porch and ignited it.
I went and watered it, and then bushes started exploding all around me and embers, and I thought, holy Moses, it's the burning bush. It's time to get the hell out of here.
First, though, Brian had to run back inside. He was taking care of his terminally ill 84-year-old cousin at the time.
I got her ID and my ID, and we left. We left everything. We left it to whatever happened was going to happen.
Authorities had issued evacuation orders for Yarnell on Sunday afternoon before the fire reached people's homes. Brian says he and his cousin waited for hospice workers who'd promised to pick them up. When nobody arrived, Brian slung his cousin's arm over his shoulder and walked outside, in shorts and flip-flops, to a landscape on fire.
But I was pretty well determined that, you know, I was going to get her out of here and whatever it took.
It was slow going. The flames around them were as high as a two-story house. They had to slog about a quarter of a mile through thick black smoke before they found help. Along the way, Brian heard tires and propane tanks explode. He and his cousin did not get burned, but their lungs took a beating.
And then I spent the next 6 hours in the hospital, so I didn't really know what had happened until after they had released me.
It wasn't safe to go back for about a week. When Brian returned home, he saw the porch was charred, but his house was still standing. The rest of town wasn't as lucky. The fire left a quarter of houses in Yarnell in ashes. To another man in town.
It looked like hell.
That's Vito Austin, a general contractor. In the 3 years since the fire, he and others have jump-started a lot of home building around Yarnell. We meet up with him outside a house he's working on.
Vito, nice to meet you.
How are you?
How's it going? Emmanuel. Nice to meet you.
He did not see the area until after the fire was out and all the vegetation was burned away.
I mean, every other lot you looked at looked like something just whipped through there and destroyed everything they had and left the skeletons, meaning the washer, the dryer, the refrigerators.
The fire also left the foundations, plumbing, and electrical wiring. Luckily for contractors like Vito, it's easier to rebuild on properties like that. He described Yarnell before the fire as landlocked, meaning nobody wanted to sell their houses. Now, after the fire.
This is a land opportunity.
A neighbor calls Vito Yarnell's Monopoly Man because he knows a good deal when he sees one. Like the empty lot he spots while we're talking.
I'm going to buy it. I'm going to clean it up and build a house on it.
In many parts of the U.S., there are few restrictions on where people can build or rebuild. researchers at the University of Wisconsin study this. They found that about a quarter of the houses lost in wildfires are rebuilt within 5 years. So homeowners are either willing to face the risk of wildfire or they're new to the area and they don't know what they're in for. In Yarnell, about half of the houses lost in the fire are in some stage of rebuilding. Vito says a home that's burned down can sprout worthwhile possibilities on the same land.
If you can pick up a piece of parcel that has a septic system in it, has the water, and has a drive, has a little mother-in-law house already on it, and flip it, you know, by building a nice home and help rebuilding the community.
The county can't stop people from building in places that have burned down and might just burn again. If somebody owns a piece of land, it's up to that person to decide whether to rebuild. Local government hasn't made new zoning rules since the 2013 fire, but it does require new construction to meet fire codes that require materials that prevent fires from spreading. When homeowners don't choose to rebuild, it opens a door for developers, big companies, and small-timers like Vito to flip and profit from abandoned properties.
These are all new.
When Vito explains the math behind this, he gets pretty excited.
I've only put $3,500 into it.
Yeah,
I sold it to the neighbor for $3,500 more.
Vito hopes to buy from people who've chosen to move away from Yarnell, but most homeowners aren't going anywhere. That includes Brian Smith.
This is for my wife and my grandkids and my family. This is it.
The memory of those 19 firefighters who died on June 30th, 2013 still haunts him.
I didn't even know that until later, and then they were all about the age of my grandchildren, so I felt really like shit. I don't know why. It just seemed like I couldn't do enough or anything. That's how I felt. I don't know.
Most of those men were in their 20s.
And those kids... Well, that's... I can't say much more.
The Yarnell Hill fire burned more than 8,000 acres and caused more than $8.5 million in property damage. He sums up the way he feels about surviving the fire to me and my colleague, Eric.
This is it. You're not afraid of fire again.
Fuck, no, I'm not afraid of nothing.
Thanks to Reveal's Emmanuel Martinez for that story. Residents like Brian Smith may say they're afraid of nothing, but maybe they should be. Just this summer, 3 years after the Yarnell Hill fire, another one scorched 4,000 acres on the other side of town. This time, no houses burned and nobody died. So what does it take to get a community to change, to take steps to protect their homes? For Flagstaff, Arizona, it took a catastrophe so big that the town couldn't ignore the threat any longer. It happened in June of 2010 and got a lot of coverage from local TV stations like ABC 15 in Arizona.
Flames from the Schultz fire are approaching people's backyards.
The fast-moving Schultz fire has certainly left its mark.
And what has taken days to burn will now take decades to recover.
During the Schultz fire, 15,000 acres burned and 1,000 people were evacuated. Now, no one died at the time, but a couple weeks later, monsoon rains triggered a deadly landslide. See, really hot fire like this one basically melts soil into glass. Water beads right off, and when there's enough rain, it runs right down the mountains into the town.
Families in Flagstaff cleaning up after floodwaters rushed through that area, catching many off guard. Dozens of homes damaged, and even a 12-year-old girl was killed. But the worst may still be to come.
Instead of waiting for things to get worse, Flagstaff did something different. People there voted overwhelmingly to invest in a safer landscape. That meant thinning the forest, teaching people to clear brush and get rid of anything around their houses that can fuel a fire, and completely transforming their fire department. Now, when you think of a firefighter, you tend to think of them rushing around town in those big red engines. I mean, that's the job, right? But in Flagstaff these days, the job sounds more like this.
Beautiful.
Some firefighters here say they spend 90% of their time on prevention, like thinning dense, unhealthy forests. It's a radical shift.
reveals Ike Sriskandaraja hung out with members of the Flagstaff Fire Department. They showed him what they're doing to keep their own town from burning.
So it's a little muddy out there, so it's probably good we're taking our truck.
I'm out here with Wildland Fire Supervisor from the Flagstaff Fire Department, Skylar Lofgren. He's energetic, funny, and fire experienced.
You can see kind of where our decals got burnt off a little bit. See that?
He's pointing at the Flagstaff Fire crest on the side of his truck. It melted off because the fire he was at was so hot. But responding to fire is less and less part of the job.
So right now we're looking at about 10 to 12 folks cutting limbs off of trees, and they're dropping trees down onto the ground.
A crew of city firefighters is out here every day cutting down small and medium ponderosa pines.
Now he's making sure his cuts are lined up so that tree's gonna drop exactly where he wants it to. Right where he wanted it, next to the pile. When people think a city fire department, this is probably the last thing that would come to their mind.
Skyler's not your typical city firefighter. He worked for Wally Covington's research institute. For years, he collected data on forests throughout the Southwest and knows the dangers an unhealthy forest can pose.
The biggest threat for the city of Flagstaff is wildland fire, the number one threat.
The problem is we don't see that threat for what it actually is. The 70,000 people who live in Flagstaff, they're a hiking, mountain biking, outdoorsy crowd. And they love that their town is encircled by the largest contiguous ponderosa pine forest in the country. See, they, like most of us, see lots of trees and think, that's a healthy forest. But firefighters like Skylar see that same forest as a potential ring of fire around the city, the byproduct of 100 years of timber policy that promoted dense growth and forest management that suppressed all fire from the forest. The trick is getting the people of Flagstaff to see it that way. And unlike most of the places we've visited this hour, they were able to recognize that threat and act on it.
We've had this whole social change in Flagstaff from cutting any trees bad to now, no, we need to cut, we need to take out some trees so we don't lose all of our trees.
In a landmark vote, the residents of Flagstaff approved funding to cut down trees to save the forest and their town. It was a forward-looking decision to turn back the clock on their ponderosa pines.
Looking back in the past pre-settlement times, this forest was described more savanna-like, which is, I mean, if you think about that, thinking of ponderosa pines and then like savanna-like, they said you could ride a horse at 40 miles an hour through the woods and not hit a tree.
And now Skylar's team is turning this modern forest back into frontier savanna. Most of the clearing is done with logging machines, but the fine detail work can only be done with the painterly touch of a hand-operated chainsaw.
We don't want a uniform landscape. We try to make it what we call clumpy groupy. So we determine within a group.
Clumpy groupy?
Yep, clumpy groupy. And it's a scientific term. It's kind of wild. That's a prescription, like right? Yeah, let's make some cookies here. I want some clumpy groupy cookies right now. So we're out here on the site and we say this is a group. And within this group, we want clumps.
Clumpy groupy is the opposite of a dark, dense forest. There's lots of open space around clumps of trees. It's also fire safe. If lightning strikes in a clumpy groupy forest, the fire sweeps along the ground, clearing underbrush, dead things, and lots of little trees. Right now, the forest still has dense patches of these small trees that would be explosively flammable. Young pines are sometimes called ladder fuels because flames climb up one tree, jump to a slightly bigger one, till they reach the tallest treetops. And that's when a mild fire turns into a dangerous wildfire. But there's only so much Skylar and his team can do out here to reduce the risk to people and property. Residents have to chip in to protect their own homes. As he drives us back toward town, we pass a neighborhood nestled into the forest. And Skylar points out the window. Some residents aren't doing themselves any favors.
You know, if there was a fire to start in here, this is going to get hot. He's stacked up firewood all against his wooden fence that leads all the way to his home. And it's right up underneath trees.
Basically, there's a trail of kindling leading right to their doorstep.
we would say, you know what we would recommend, sir, is maybe not piling that firewood underneath all these trees against this wooden fence that leads to your home. We would recommend piling this maybe uphill, upslope, and away from any trees, you know, in an open area. So if there was an ember to land in there, it wouldn't consequently burn up the wood, burn up the forest, burn up your wooden fence, and then your home.
Educating homeowners so they don't make stupid mistakes is a full-time job here for Gerilyn Byrne.
And your last name's Byrne. That's too good.
I think she's gotten that before.
It is very good.
Gerilyn is a dedicated specialist at the Flagstaff Fire Department who helps neighborhoods adapt to fire. Some of the most desirable neighborhoods here push into forest. Now, all over America, developers keep building further and further out into wildland. And people who want to live in the beauty of nature with the amenities of a nearby city keep moving in.
So where are we right now?
So right now we're in Pine Canyon. This neighborhood, from the ground up, used FireWise construction.
By FireWise, she means the planners of this neighborhood used fire-resistant building materials. They created several entry and exit points for firefighters, and they made sure the yards here are clear of dry leaves and brush around each house.
If a fire were to come through this neighborhood, they would be pretty well protected. There's a lot of defensive space. They have great access here.
Federal, state, and local agencies partner to set these standards. There are more than 1,000 communities recognized as FireWise.
We feel comfortable as firefighters coming into this area and being able to defend these homes.
This is a gold standard.
This would be a gold standard neighborhood, yes.
The people of Pine Canyon have to be gold standard.
Should a fire start to the south of Flagstaff here, they would be the first community that would be impacted.
But it can cost hundreds of dollars to hire someone to cut down a dead tree on your property. Maintaining that cleared space can take time and money. As I looked around at Pine Canyon's manicured lawns with driveways full of BMWs and Benzes, I had to ask Gerilyn.
Is it only possible to have a gold standard FireWise community? Does it need to be a wealthy community?
That is a good question.
Most of the time, it does. For lower-income communities that can't afford to keep up with maintenance, Gerilyn doesn't ticket people. Instead, she offers cash prizes for the best-designed fire-safe yards.
We really try to encourage a more positive feedback loop with that code.
More carrot than stick.
Yes, more of the carrot, less of the stick.
Other than that, Gerilyn relies on local building codes that require new developments to manage their own thinning and keep their property clear of fuels. She understands that public outreach only works as part of a bigger picture.
So we can show them and then we can educate them, but the idea is just to, we're doing prevention on a grand scale, on this landscape scale.
Prevention work isn't just happening in neighborhoods like the one Gerilyn's in, or city-owned land like that tree thinning operation. A large part of it is happening on federal Forest Service land.
But we don't have to walk all the way down there. I just kind of wanted to come out here and kind of show you the area that we're going to be treating over the next couple years.
Matt Millar is another program director from Flagstaff's Fire Department. He takes us to the base of the Dry Lake Hills in the Coconino National Forest.
The overall goal of the project is to reduce the risk of large, high-intensity catastrophic fires and the flooding that can happen after a large fire.
We're close to where the Schultz Fire happened. That's the one that burned 15,000 acres back in 2010 and triggered a fatal landslide. Now, this place is still a risk.
There will be a lot of trees that will be removed here, which will really change the way that the forest looks.
By the time Matt's done, they may remove more than half the trees, the small and medium ones in particular. But it doesn't stop there.
Phase two will move to the top of the mountains, so eventually this whole area will have been treated.
He's pointing to a peak about 10,000 feet up. Logging machines can't reach there, so they'll need to use helicopters to thin out the trees on the highest, steepest slopes. It's ambitious and expensive, but it's part of the same plan nearly three-quarters of the town voted to approve.
The people of Flagstaff are very aware of the hazards of catastrophic fire, and they're very proactive in casting a vote to approve a $10 million bond to do this forest thinning work, which I think is a really unique situation.
They approved it because, economically, it makes sense. A captain of Flagstaff Fire put it like this. His department spent $8,000 on passing a bond worth $10 million aimed at preventing $500 million in damages. Remember, fires in these areas, where the wild meets the residential, are crazy expensive. The Schultz fire alone, which didn't actually burn a single structure, cost $12 million to fight, and another $140 million in recovery costs, like property damage.
And I think about some of the larger fires that cost $100 million or more. I think about the amount of preventative forest treatments that could be done using that money.
Matt's new on this project. Before this, he worked for years as a hotshot. They're sort of like the Navy SEALs of firefighting. They drop in and work on putting out some of the biggest, most dangerous fires in the country. And in the off season, he was going to school to get his master's degree in environmental science. And now he appreciates the slow preventative work of thinning trees up a mountain.
I think the prevention side is you can work for, you know, many years, and you know the effects may not be apparent right away. Whereas when you work in the suppression side, if you go to a fire and you work there for a few weeks, you know, you can see your progress daily, you know, as you're
when the fire's gone.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's rewarding, absolutely. But I just try and remember that, from my view, maybe that's not the right thing I should be doing. You know, I think I know enough now about fire ecology and the importance of fire in the landscape that I really enjoy working in this project because of what the end goals are.
The goal? Keeping the next big wildfire from happening. Now, this city's approach won't work everywhere, and the money to try new preventative measures won't always be there. But for now, Matt looks over the forest. Most of the slender trees he's cutting down are younger than he is. But if what he's doing works, the trees that remain could be around for another 600 years.
That piece was from Reveal's Ike Sriskandarajah. Now, there's no question, wildfires are getting worse. Like moths to a flame, humans are moving closer. As I'm speaking, 116 wildfires are burning across the United States. Global warming is one reason the number of wildfires is growing. It also contributes to our shrinking freshwater supply. When we come back, we bring you the latest on our search for some of the biggest water wasters in the state of California, in our quest to find the wet prince of Bel Air. This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey there, listeners. Julia B. Chan here, Reveal's digital editor. On a recent episode, we took a hard look at how dangerous it is to be gay in Russia today. In fact, it cost one journalist his life. He wasn't killed for what he wrote about, but because of who he was, a gay man. If you missed the show, go back and check it out. It's called Russia's New Scapegoats. Hateful anti-gay rhetoric is heard daily on Russian television and in speeches by politicians, and it's unleashing a wave of vigilante violence against the gay community. On our website, we have a photo essay that looks at both sides of this violence. Go to revealnews.org/LGBT to see the rage and resilience of Russian homophobia. That's revealnews.org/LGBT.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. All this episode, we've been talking about the growth of wildfires. Now we want to switch gears and talk about water, or more to the point, the lack of it. What happens when our water runs out? When the rain stops, the reservoirs dry up, and the tap no longer flows, but drips. 5 years into a major drought, Californians are feeling it. State government asked people to conserve. But last year, Reveal's Catherine Miskowski uncovered that hundreds of Californians are soaking in the stuff, ignoring the crisis and wasting water like there's no tomorrow. She went on a hunt for the biggest water waster in a story we called The Wet Prince of Bel Air.
I'm in Los Angeles, tooling around with Steve Kasher of LA Insider Tours.
Yeah, I think Bel Air has the biggest hedges.
Usually, Steve takes tourists to Bel Air and Beverly Hills to gawk at the luxury. What you can see of it from the street, that is. Like David Beckham's driveway and a little corner of Tom Cruise's house. House is probably the wrong word. These are estates, mansions, temples to opulence. Some of them are 30,000 square feet. From the street, it's pretty hard to see much, since many are cloistered behind towering gates and hedges.
You know, we just passed Madonna's old house, and that was on the market for $25 million.
Today, we're not here trolling for celebrities, but for extreme water wasters.
There's just green everywhere. You would have no idea that you're in California. You have no idea you're in a place that has no rain.
But finding out exactly who is using that water, or overusing it, is a lot harder than following a star map.
The water agency wouldn't share the names of the mega water users, but we didn't give up. Reporter Lance Williams, along with data journalist Mike Corey, kept the hunt going, this time using NASA satellites to help. Mike joins me in the studio. And Mike, what did you find?
We found 7 homeowners in the Bel Air neighborhood that were using a lot of water. And these are the people we think are most likely to be our top water user, who we know from a public records request had used 11.8 million gallons of water in a single year. That's enough water for 90 average families in California. So we can't say with certainty that this guy is the one guy, but we found homeowners who were using millions and millions of gallons of water.
And so who are they?
You know, it's not your household names like A-list celebrities, but it's people with a lot of money. One of the houses is actually the Beverly Hillbillies mansion, the mansion that was used in the Beverly Hillbillies, which has been greatly expanded. Some of them have like artificial waterfalls. They're people who own NBA teams or part of the Dodgers, people who own part of the Golden State Warriors, television executives, that kind of thing.
So they may not be A-list as far as celebrities, but they are A-list as far as their financial income.
Oh, yeah. These guys are billionaires.
Did any of them talk to you?
Most of them wouldn't come to the phone at all. One person said through a spokesperson that they take the report seriously. That was about it. But my favorite part about all this is after doing a lot of really complex math and trying to predict how much water they had actually used, one person read us their water bill and said that our estimate was actually pretty accurate. We estimated that he used between 2 and 4 million gallons of water, and it turned out that he had used 4 million gallons of water. So that was a pretty good day for me.
And did he have any regrets about that?
No, he basically said, I got a big property, and that this is how much water it takes to water a big property. He said he stepped up his conservation efforts, but and to some extent, that's a realistic answer. If you're going to keep a big lawn and big properties green like that, yeah, that is how much water it takes.
Yeah, but in a drought, like, get rid of your grass.
Well, I mean, I certainly have gotten rid of my grass. I think that's the reaction a lot of people have.
So explain to me how you use the satellite data and some old-fashioned reporting to pinpoint these water users.
Basically, what we do is we take advantage of some of the interesting properties of light that you remember from, like, high school science class. So you remember that there's like the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and purple part of the rainbow that you can see. And you know that there's like infrared and other things like that that are further out on the spectrum that humans can't see. But there's cameras on these satellites that use those wavelengths that we can't see and take pictures of that just like we take pictures with the camera. And then we do some math with that that basically takes advantage of the fact that plants really like to absorb as much red light as possible for photosynthesis. And they want to reflect back as much near-infrared light, so light in the infrared part of the spectrum, as they can because that's just heat. And so if you use the ratio of that infrared light to the red light, we can tell how efficiently plants are doing photosynthesis. It's fun stuff.
So basically, like, you can tell that there's a lot of plants on X property, and that tells you that they have to be using a lot of water.
Yeah, we can say, like, we want to find properties that are very green, very wet, and very large. And sort of at that intersection is where we're going to find our biggest water users.
So why'd you do this? I mean, if people can afford to pay for the water, then why not let them have it? I mean, what difference does it make if we know their names? Is this just about shaming people?
I think it's a really good question. But the bottom line is, even though these guys aren't doing anything illegal, and I want to emphasize that, but I just can't think of a resource that is more a public resource than water. There's only so much water. We all have to share it. And I think, like, if we are going to have an intelligent conversation about how that water should be used, I think we need to know how that water is being used. And I think it certainly blew my mind that there are people who own like 13 acres in Bel Air where I haven't watered my lawn in 2 years. I should say about that guy in particular, Jerry Parencio, who is a former CEO of Univision, it kind of seems that after we talked to him, pretty soon after that, I got some new satellite photos, and it looks like he stopped watering his lawn. So for one thing, I think the publicity does get people to change their behavior because they know people are aware of it. But I think, like I said, I just think it's water is such an important resource that we all share. I think we should get to know who is using it.
Since we first reported this story last year, state lawmakers took action. What happened?
Actually, in response partially to Lance and Catherine's earlier stories, Governor Jerry Brown signed a law that requires local water agencies for the first time to set limits on how much water residential customers can use when a statewide water emergency has been declared. We're actually not in a statewide water emergency right now, but the next time that one is declared, if someone goes over the new restrictions, they can actually be fined up to $500 for every 700 gallons that go over the limit. And the law also makes the names of anyone who violates the law public.
That's Reveal's Michael Corey. Thanks for joining us, buddy.
Thanks.
Our show was edited by Cheryl Duvall. Ike Srikandaraja was our lead producer. Eric Segarra and Emmanuel Martinez reported for today's show with contributions from Scott Pham and Jennifer LaFleur. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our head of studio is Krista Scharfenberg, and Amy Pyle is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.